Well, it seemed like he was saying that kama bija, or karmic seeds, can be eliminated in some cases by transfer of merit, sending love and light, or metta bhavana. Metta means loving kindness. Like Brahma Vihara, the first is metta. Loving kindness based transfer of merit to the person affected by our wrong speech or wrong action in a past life that created a karmic seed, by successfully, effectively transferring merit from me to the one I harmed by wrong speech, wrong action, that can get rid of my karmic seeds in some cases, it seems, he said. But if that other cannot receive them because they're not in a state of mind of freedom from basically greed, anger, or strong ignorance, if they're not free of those three poisons, if not free of a strong manifestation of those three poisons, then they can't, they're not going to be in a receptive state of mind to our transfer of merit or to our sending of love and seeking to transfer merit. Therefore, our seeds can't go away if they're not going to receive. But that doesn't mean that we're bound from achievement by that. Yeah, it's first of all, I don't fully understand the metaphysics of it, so I can only tell you as much as it seems to me. Absolutely, speech and action with others that is associated with wrong speech, wrong action, or karmic, you know, formation of karmic liability, some kind of distortion in speech action that is some degree of harmfulness or not virtue, establishes a metaphysical connection. The strength of that connection is, you know, quite variable and changes over time. And to some degree, what seems to be said here is that further spiritual activity of a positive nature, like transfer of merit to that other person, because there still is a resonance between that person and the karmic seed we've established by our wrong action speech with them. Because of the resonance between the acquiring of a karmic seed, I mean, again, this is all just a way of talking about it. A karmic seed is acquired. That karmic seed has a metaphysical resonance to the other person still. Further benevolent action, such as transfer of merit particularly, to that other person, when received, will indeed change or reduce or get rid of, possibly, I guess, our karmic seed that was formed by our activity with them. So, yes. Now, does that mean that every single person that we had every single kind of non-virtuous interaction with for the entirety of all of our incarnations, we're tied to them all? Well, maybe. But how strong is the tie? Just because I imagine something doesn't mean it appears in some alternate dimension. But if I spend lots and lots and lots of time on it, it might appear in an altered dimension. What if, I'm not sure, helping others receive merit by what? Does what? Yes, you can say that. Ra talked about karma, forgiveness as a break on the wheel of karma. Karma as entropy, as inertia. And inertia as the tendency of objects in motion, or the tendency of phenomena in a certain state to remain in that state, which could mean a karmic accumulation to remain as is, accumulated, versus dissolving or diminishing, you know, karmic seeds or something like that. So forgiveness as a break on inertia, forgiveness as a break, BRAKE, on karma, is a change state against continued inertia, or a change of state versus continuance of the state, which includes the state of karma. And so, to the extent that we forgive others, to the extent that they receive our forgiveness, whether it's verbally or simply metaphysically, right? I forgive my dead relatives for harming me. That's okay, because they're not dead. They're just not in this dimension. And so the thought of a true deep mind forgiveness, you know, authentic, true, deep forgiveness of somebody, even if they're not alive, touches them, metaphysically, I would think, and may help them. However, it does depend on their state of mind as to how receptive they are to it, as to how it might help them with their karma, or their moving out of a continuance of their distorted state of mind. Yes, absolutely, of course. I mean, hurting a loved one, strongly hurting or harming a loved one has different effects than strongly harming a stranger. Strongly harming an ant has a different karmic effect or different changes in mind than strongly harming a cat or a dog. Well, metaphysically, parents are really important. That's the point. And so harming parents physically or verbally is really troublesome, is really problematic. I mean, I have a friend, and I won't name him, but who I said before, when he was at the dinner table with his parents, and he's in his 30s, 40s when we're talking here, commonly with his mother and brother, I believe, or sister, say, you know, fuck you, harsh at the table. That's like normal in their family. That's really a problem. More than they realize. They can say, oh, it's just the way we talk to each other. Yeah, okay. And it has more adverse karmic effects than saying, I'm really angry at you, mom or dad. And they don't know it. It's destructive to their state of mind more than they realize.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I watch a lot of old movies and new movies. And I can see, as you see, old movies, TV shows, people would never talk to each other the way they talk in modern movies, which is really quite harsh speech all the time. I mean, there's harsh speech. It's considered funny, you know? Punching somebody or hurting somebody physically is considered funny. It's not funny, actually. And it's very crude. It's very degenerative to mental conditions or mental state. It's very harmful to an understanding of morality, virtue, ethics, which is the basis of the path. And so it normalizes wrong speech. Yeah, well, people don't realize the environmental changes that come by normalized wrong speech, wrong action, behavior, socially normalized harmful activity. They don't realize, as you're sort of suggesting, the environmental changes. One is no longer living in a respectful society. One is returning to a savagery. And that's absolutely what the New World Order Illuminati folks want society to become. Dog eat dog, might makes right, and crude and rough and rude, and without any of the moral or ethical qualities of right restraint. Right restraint. It's not one of the Eightfold Path, but we can understand it related to right speech, right action, right view, right? All of our studying about theory is right view that hopefully, ideally, ought to be translated into a deeper understanding and practice of right speech, right action. And that affects the environment. And so that's the real indictment of the just do it, I me my, selfie-based narcissism being pushed culturally as a part of this, you know, New World Order cultural reengineering, which is an elevation over an elevation of free will above an understanding of the consequences of wrong action. Now, free will, the simple, you know, just do it, or do what thou wilt is the whole of the law. That lie becoming normalized or taught widely represents a deep revaluation in which freedom of doing self-willed activity or free choice, free will to do whatever you want, which is a fine thing, is raised above an understanding of the consequences of moral activity. It's free will in the service of collective demoralization. Demoralization doesn't only mean I feel discouraged, it also means society or individuals without morality. Without morality means without any understanding of right and wrong action, or right and wrong activity, which can really simply be framed as, you know, skillful, unskillful, which is simply based on the consequences of such activity. You know, morality based in a realistic understanding of consequence. You know, it's right or skillful or good because the consequences are helpful and supportive, and it's wrong or bad or unskillful because the consequences are weakening to me, to mind and body. They will hurt me in the future. So it's good to do whatever you like, but if you don't know that there are going to be long-term consequences, and you don't have some sense of what the consequences are going to be, and the clear distinction, discernment, that indeed some activity will harm me and some activity will help me, aside from you and help you or hurt you, if one doesn't have that understanding, discernment of consequences of activity, speech and behavior particularly, then one thinks that the highest value, like, you know, the whole of the law, the distortion and mistake of Crowley's dictum that do what thou wilt is the whole of the law, is that it's not the whole of the law. There's another law called karma, and that's called consequentiality, and it needs to be discerned in terms of what helps and what harms. And so you can talk to your parents and curse them out, and you're doing what you will, and yet that's not the whole of the law, because there are going to be consequences. There is karmic consequentiality, and that means long-term effects coming back at me based on my activity. And nobody really knows that or cares about that, except for people who are thinking about morality, which could be Christian, could be of any religion, but it's deep in the heart of Buddhism, Hinduism, Buddhism with Shila, and Hinduism with, you know, Yama Niyama, or the ways, what is good to do and what's good to avoid. And Buddhism has its own understanding of Shila, obviously, as a fundamental basis of any of the spiritual path. And society is getting very, very distorted, and in which basically freedom of action is valued higher than comprehension of the consequences of free action. And humanity has always been distorted in that way, meaning people act freely and don't think about, you know, they leap before they look. They speak before they think. They, you know, think before you speak, or look before you leap, or consider consequences before you act. That's a difficult teaching, and that leads to some restraint, wise restraint. And many people don't want that. So they think non-restraint is the whole of the law. Free-wheeling, free-willing, non-restraint inactivity is the whole of the law, they are going to go to hell if they go into wrong speech, wrong actions strongly, and wrong thought too. So, okay, you want to act like a dog, you want to, you know, put a tail in your ass or something and walk around. I mean, there are people doing this. Yeah, the anonymity of the online, you know, cyberspace lets some people freely express harmful speech. Feeling, you know, I mean, it's good that they can get it out, I guess. The problem is that they're actually going to hurt them. They're hurting themselves by setting up karmic seeds that will ripen in the future in various ways. And particularly, I think, I mean, what the only final point I make is that when you curse out your parents and when you curse out loved ones, you're degenerating your own mind. You are fragmenting your long-term mental condition, whether you know it or not. It doesn't matter that you don't know it. It would be good if you did, but if you don't, it still works. Ignorance of the law doesn't cancel the law. It simply leads one to self-harming, generally, and or supports self-harming because people don't know consequentiality. But the people who... I mean, I see this too. I used to curse more, and I'm a little more careful with it. And you know, there's an interview with London Paul on Rogue Money, and he even addresses that little bit, talking about how angry he is at the U.S. bombing Syria. And restrained, you know, kind of expressed his self-restraint in the interview to not get into cursing and getting into expletives and that type of speech. Because he basically said it doesn't really capture the meaning very well, which is a very sophisticated intellectual criticism, critique of cursing, and expression of significance. But it does get out the feeling. The question again, you know, and again it's back to non-restraint versus restraint as it supports release versus further attachment. Sometimes non-restraint cursing somewhat, non-restraint as an example of cursing, is associated with release, not further attachment. And in other cases, non-restraint strengthens attachment. And in some cases, restraint weakens attachment. And in other cases, restraint strengthens attachment. You see? It's very subtle. Yeah, well, there was a time when I caught myself pointing with my index finger, making a point, pointing at someone's face, pointing at people's faces in conversation, making a point with my finger, point, my index finger's point, end of the finger, and then realizing that that's aggressive, that's violent, making a point, pointing in their face, even if I'm not, you know, so close, even if I'm 3 feet away or 10 feet away, pointing at somebody's face, making a point, I trained myself not to point to their face. I point my finger away from their face, making a point. Because there is some transmission of energy out of the finger at someone's head. And that's called violence. Oh yeah, same thing with staring. You can aggressively stare or be careful not to. One can make very intense points and stare in a hateful way, not knowing one's feeling some hate and aggression. Even if it's not even hate at the person, I hate the matter that they're not understanding that I'm trying to clarify, and I'm making my point staring at them, or eye to eye, making eye contact. But it's not just making eye contact, it's making eye contact, expressing anger that actually has some bearing, some resonance with aggression to that person that I'm looking in the eyes of. And therefore, being careful in the making of eye contact, at the quality of mind expressed in the quality or the nature of the speech, to make sure that it's harmless. How about that? Yes, and sometimes it's actually beneficial to call somebody a fool and amp them up. Gautama called people, you know, he talked about the guy, the monk. We just talked about this before. The monk who had sex with his wife because his mother-in-law wanted a baby, and that was, I don't know where this was, but this was the first prohibition against sexual misconduct, or sexuality, I think, even in the Sangha. There wasn't even a rule against it because no monk wanted to do it. No. He had sex with his wife after he was a monk at his mother-in-law's urging because she wanted an heir, a grandson, a grandchild. And Gautama called him you worthless man. Worthless man. If Gautama calls you a worthless man, you're in trouble. And, you know, if you arouse the ire, the anger of a very highly evolved being, you really fucked up. And you really made a mistake. You really did wrong action. And why would he do that? Now, he's partly doing that as a lesson to everybody else who didn't want his ire, that really is wrong action. And it's also possible, if you really want to hurt somebody, to amp them up. But that's probably wrong action or wrong speech. Yes, hang themselves with their own anger. Absolutely. Yeah, and there are certain people that I would say right action dictates non-response. You know, they say something and you say nothing. No response. Silence. Moving away. Nothing. They get nothing. You get nothing from me. Because your intentions are so distorted, or one can perceive that the intensity, degree of distortion of the other person so much that silence is right action. So anyway, thank you again. And as always, our talk is interesting and pretty useful for those who are thinking deeply about process. Take good care of yourselves. See you next time, and good night.